Thank you for tuning in to Emmanuel Faith Community Church. We hope you enjoy today's sermon.
Well, good morning, Emmanuel Faith. So good to see you. My name's Ryan, and I have the joy of being one of our pastors here. The year was 1946 when the classic movie It's a Wonderful Life was released. And since then, it's been one of those classics that people just revisit each Christmas season. Raise your hand if you watch this like on a fairly regular basis. Yeah, it is a beautiful movie. And so spoiler alert, all right, I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. But the statute of limitations is over. You've had like 80 years to watch it. So if you haven't by now, you should today, all right? So the film is about George Bailey. He's a good-hearted man who lives with a sense of sacrifice and generosity to the people around him, including his family. And one Christmas Eve, there's a deposit of money that's misplaced, and it means that his family and business is going to be in financial ruin, and he's facing this moment of despair. And George Bailey considers taking his own life, at which point he's visited by an angel named Clarence. And Clarence takes him on this like view of all the impact that he's having in the lives of people around him and what their life would look like without him. And it's this moment that George Bailey gets of perspective, to be able to zoom out from his life, to see what other people's lives would be like if he weren't there, to see what kind of lives they would live if he hadn't made the decisions that he had made. And it's this moment where he gets a view of all the good things that he has in his life, and then he gets to enter back in with a greater sense of vision and purpose and gratitude for the life that he does have. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could too get that kind of perspective on our life? Like, wouldn't it be nice if we could know how we're impacting the lives of people around us and how the love that we're showing is making a difference? And wouldn't it be nice if we could even like fast forward a little bit and know the way that a small act of kindness was gonna shape or reshape someone's life, a moment of sacrificial love that was gonna shape or reshape the life of a family? I think of one person that would love to have known the way that his decision was going to impact the rest of his life. His name is Ronald Gerald Wayne. Anybody know who Ronald Gerald Wayne is? Ronald Gerald Wayne was one of the co-founders of Apple Computer. And in 1976, he sold his 10% share of Apple Computer for, drumroll, $800. He then later accepted a $1,500 offer to forfeit any claims against Apple that he still had. So $2,300 in total, okay? 10% of Apple, which today is worth $300 billion. You think he wished he had like a Clarence the Angel moment? Where like an angel would take him and was like, hey, don't sell this for $800. Someday it's going to be worth $300 billion. My guess is you've made some bad decisions in your life, but I'm also going to go out on a limb and say none of them have cost you $300 billion. But I do think there's a part of each one of us where if we would have had different perspective, if we would have seen how continuing to stay loving and faithful, if we would have seen how continuing to stick with a job, if we would have seen how making that move or not making that move, making that investment or not making that investment, staying obedient to Jesus in a moment, if we would have seen how it would have affected the rest of our life or the life of others, we might have made a different decision. See, one of my problems with God is that he doesn't always fill me in on what he's doing. Like he doesn't say, hey Ryan, this is a really important moment. Like don't miss this. He doesn't say, Ryan, this conversation could change the rest of your life or the rest of this person's life. Like he doesn't do that. Like we don't get those Clarence the Angel types of moments. So wouldn't it be nice to know Wouldn't it be nice to sort of have a vision for and a lens for how we don't miss those watershed moments of our life, how we don't miss those moments of small acts of obedience that will lead us to the center of the story that God is telling? Wouldn't that be nice? Well, that's exactly what today's message is all about. So if you have a Bible, open with me to Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4. We've been in this great short book over the last few weeks entitled Ruth. I hope you've been encouraged. I have absolutely loved studying this book every week, and the Lord's taught me so many new things, and I'm so grateful. Let me catch you up if you haven't been with us. Ruth starts with a family by the name of Elimelech's family, and there's a famine in Bethlehem. So Elimelech and his wife Naomi and his two sons, they leave Bethlehem and they move to where? Right, exactly. They move to Moab, right? Moab is east of Eden. Moab is like sort of running away from God in a sense. And in Moab, things go from bad to worse, where Elimelech dies and his two sons die. And so Naomi, his wife, is left with her two daughters-in-law, Orpah Winfrey and Ruth. And Orpah decides, when Naomi says, I'm going to move back to Bethlehem, I've heard that there is a harvest there. Orpah decides that she's going to stay in Moab, and Ruth, her daughter-in-law, decides to go with her. They get into Bethlehem, and Ruth starts working in a man named Boaz's field, and things go pretty well in that field. So Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, hey, you should go propose to Boaz. He seems really kind, and I think he likes you. Go propose to him, which was absolutely taboo in that culture. But she does it, and Ruth not only proposes, but she asks for more than just Boaz's hand in marriage. She asks for Boaz to redeem her late husband's family, to become their redeemer, rescuing his family name and his family land. Well, Boaz breaks it to Ruth on the threshing floor that there's a relative who's closer to Elimelech than he is. And so it's actually his duty and his responsibility to do what Ruth is asking Boaz to do. So Boaz sent Ruth home to Naomi, and he said that he was going to address it with that redeemer first thing in the morning so that he could have an answer to Ruth as to what her future and Naomi's future would look like. That's where we pick up the story. It's going to be in the morning. And I just want to say that if you were to pause the story here and ask Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz, like, what's your perspective? What's your vision? What do you sense that God is doing in this moment? I think each one of them would say, we don't really know. Like, we're just being faithful. Like, we're just living with love for the people around us. We're just trying to do the next right thing. That's it. Nothing all that big. Just the next right thing. And these characters are going to show us that small steps of obedience are the very thing to position us to be a part of God's grand story. Your small steps of obedience that are seemingly inconsequential could be the very thing that put you in the epicenter of the story that God is telling. And I want to show you that through the lives of Boaz and Ruth and Naomi in this chapter. Ruth chapter 4, are you there? Wonderful. Here we go. Remember, Ruth is waiting on an answer from Boaz, and Boaz has to go talk to the relative that's closer to Elimelech to see if he's going to fulfill his duty as the redeemer. Verse 1. Here we go. Now, Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. Now, the city gate in ancient Israel was the place where business was typically done. So he's sitting there, and behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. What a coincidence. It's almost like God is in the story. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, and sit down here. And he turned aside and he sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Now, let's just say time out here and pause here. Boaz told Ruth that he was going to go and take care of the matter first thing in the morning. And what does Boaz do? He goes and he takes care of the matter first thing in the morning. You have to remember that Boaz was absolutely shocked to see Ruth on that threshing floor that evening. He had different plans for the morning. He's in harvest time. He's gonna store grain. He's gonna sell grain. He's got a plan, but he gives Ruth his word, I'm gonna handle this first thing, and that's exactly what he does. My appreciation for Boaz just continues to grow as I study this story because he shows us what small acts of obedience looks like. It looks like choosing character over convenience. That's what it looks like. It looks like being a person of your word. That when you say you're gonna do something, you do it. That you do it when you say you're going to do it. And I love, if you go back and you read verses 1 and 2, I love that Boaz just goes to the city gates and he just sits there. Like, he has this quiet confidence that if God's in this, he's gonna put the pieces together. Like, he doesn't need to go and find the guy and twist his arm and tell him that he wants to marry Ruth or that he has to marry Ruth. Like, no. He just sits there and he waits. The other thing he does is he gathers 10 of the most prominent men in the city and tells them, you sit here too. You're gonna be a part of this because we're gonna do this the right way. And I love that Boaz is obviously a man of immense influence in the city of Bethlehem. Like, if 10 of the elders are gonna sit at his command, you know that he's a powerful person in this town. And how does he use his power? He uses his power not to build himself up, not to benefit his own business, not to benefit himself in any way. He leverages his power for the sake of two vulnerable widows in Bethlehem. And I think, oh my goodness, this is a man who's choosing to live with character over convenience. And it's going to shape the lives of every person around him. He doesn't know in this moment how his small steps of obedience are going to have ripple effects of grace that you get to live in today. But they do. That's Boaz. And so the story continues, verse 3. And then he said to the Redeemer, this closer relative to Elimelech, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So most likely they're probably cousins. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. So Boaz says, I'm next in line, and if you don't redeem the field, then I'm gonna buy the field. And he said, I will redeem it. Now, if you were with us last week, when Ruth asked Boaz not just to be her husband, but to be her late husband's redeemer, to redeem Elimelech, there were two Hebrew laws that she triggered into effect. Do you remember this? One of the Hebrew laws was about the land, and that's what everybody thinks they're talking about at this point in the passage. That was called, does anybody remember? The kinsman redeemer law, right? The kinsman redeemer, and it was about family land. The other law, which is way more awkward, is entitled, anybody remember? The levirate marriage law, right? And the levirate marriage law said that if your brother died without an heir, you had to marry his wife in order to perpetuate his line. That gets a little bit awkward, doesn't it? Like I said last week, it gives you a vested interest in who your family members marry, for sure. At this point in the story, this redeemer only thinks that they're talking about the land. So it sounds like a really, really good investment. So listen to what he says. In verse 4, he said, I will buy it. And then Boaz drops this bomb. The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead. in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Now, a few weeks ago, my son bought a sweatshirt on Depop, this sort of like secondhand online store. And the guy that sent him the sweatshirt also sent him a free hat. Like, you buy the sweatshirt and you get this hat for free. That's nothing compared to the deal that this Redeemer just got. You buy the field and you get Ruth thrown in the deal, but not for free. Not for free. We'll talk about it in just a moment. And I want you to hear, and I want you to notice that Boaz knows exactly what Ruth was asking that night before on the threshing floor. Because he says that he's going to buy the field and he's going to marry Ruth in order to, say it with me, church, perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. He understands exactly what Ruth was asking for. And see, in the eyes of the community, Elimelech was as good as dead. He was as good as gone. He was done. So this closer Redeemer is like, sign me up. I want in on that. That's a decent deal for land, and it's going to stay in my family. Well, praise be to God. But Boaz and Ruth are taking big risks because they believe that God specializes in lost causes, and they refuse to just let good enough be good enough. They step into the story that God is telling by their faithful obedience. It says this, then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. So take my right of redemption for yourself because I cannot redeem it. Now wait, as I was studying and reading about the Levirate law, it is a law. I guess it's not the Levirate suggestion. It's a law. And I want you to notice why this person, this other Redeemer, won't redeem the land. He says, because it will impair my own inheritance. He doesn't say, I can't do it. He says, I won't do it. See, here's the thing. Without Ruth, if he buys this land, then that land stays in his family. That land goes to his kids and their kids and their kids and their kids. That land builds up his name without Ruth. But with Ruth, he buys this land and has kids with Ruth, then that land is Ruth's or their child's, and then because that child's also his child, part of his land is also going to that child. So if he says yes to marrying Ruth and they have kids, it turns into an absolutely terrible investment for him. And see, for this Redeemer, obedience was too costly. It cost too much. And I want you to see that in the midst of all that's going on in this story, it's about what Boaz is giving up, not about what he's getting. And Boaz shows us from the very beginning of this story that small obedience looks like character over convenience, and now he shows us that it looks like sacrifice over self-preservation because he's willing to pay the cost for something that will not even remain in his own family. See, he's buying something that will be in somebody else's name. Speaking of names, what's the name of the Redeemer who was closest to Elimelech? What's his name? Look in there. What's his name? It's not listed. He's Mr. No Name in this story. And I love the way that Carolyn Custis James, in her great book, The Gospel of Ruth, puts it when she says, ironically, the man who seeks to preserve his inheritance loses his name in the process. See, he's fighting and clawing to hold on to his inheritance, and all the while, thousands of years later, the story is being told, and his name is not in it because he wanted to protect his name, because he wanted to save what was his, because he was unwilling to do what the law commanded and asked him to do. He was unwilling to sacrifice, and now he's just Mr. No Name in the story of Boaz and Ruth. In essence, he echoes what Jesus 1,000 years plus later would teach when he said, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. To deny yourself and take up your cross. A cross, that is a symbol not just of sacrifice, but of sacrifice for the sake of love, of giving yourself in love for others and for their flourishing. That's exactly what Boaz is doing in this story. He's giving of himself for the sake of others, that they would flourish. For whoever would save his life will lose it. Well, that happened to Mr. No Name. We don't know his name. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. That's exactly what happens with Boaz. In verse 11, we see this prayer blessing that his name would be made great, and we're talking about him today. He had no idea that his seemingly small steps of obedience, living out Torah, would have ripple effects that would cause a group of people to gather a few thousand years later and talk about his story today. But he's willing to sacrifice instead of preserving his own name. And ironically, that's the very posture that causes God to preserve his name. If you try to hold on to your life, if you try to protect your life, you're eventually going to lose it. But if you give it away, that's when you find out what it means to really, truly live. And I love pastoring this church because I have seen this happen and see it happen in so many different ways, and I get a front row seat to it, and I'm so grateful for that. Over the just the last month in December, we had a few hundred people serving at our Snowball Bash and just trying our best to bless and minister to foster, adoptive, and kinship families, and God did great things there. Last weekend, we had our Christmas concert, five concerts where we saw thousands of people come and we got the chance to hold out the good news of Christmas to them. It took hundreds and hundreds of volunteers in our choir, in our orchestra, people serving hot chocolate and cookies and greeting. It took a whole army of people, and God did beautiful things through it. We saw volunteers from our Love ESCO team serve in unison with our Escondido police to clean up what's called the jungle, and it was just an absolute mess, and there was partnership there, and it was beautiful. All of it is people taking up their cross, loving those around them, sacrificing so that others can benefit. And I just wonder what it would look like for you to say, the small steps of obedience are not too costly for me. I wonder if there's blessing you're forfeiting because you're unwilling to say, I'll step into that awkward. I'll step in and love. I'll step in, and maybe it's sending somebody a meal. Maybe it's just sending a quick text message to somebody or giving somebody a call that God would put on your heart. Maybe it's inviting somebody to come with you on Christmas Eve. I don't know what it looks like specifically for you, but I do know this, that when you choose the small steps of obedience in sacrificing for others rather than trying to preserve your own name, God infuses that with his grace and does something more with it than you could ever ask or think or dream or imagine. Now, the legal stuff, verse 7. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Can you imagine a legally binding contract being entered into with a rainbow sandal? Praise be to God. The lawyers in our midst are like, no, you can't do it like that. Verse 9. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I've bought this land out of the hand of Naomi and all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." And I just quick time out. I want to point out to you that Boaz, this man of character that we first saw on that threshing floor, that we saw with him showing up to the city gate first thing because he said he would, is also showing his character and saying, "We're going to do this deal the right way. We're going to cross all the T's. We're going to dot all of the I's, because partial obedience isn't obedience." Somebody needs to write that down today. Verse 11. "And then all the people who gathered at the gate and the elders said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman.'" Now, a quick time. I wish we had time to go into the whole story of Rachel and Leah. It is a shocker, to say the least. But their point is God used them, these two women, to build up the house of Israel. From Rachel and Leah come the 12 sons of Jacob that become the 12 tribes of Israel. Then we have mentioned Judah and Tamar. We talked about that last week. You can go listen to it online. We can only talk about that story one time every year. So we've already done that, okay? It's just that awkward, all right? But what you need to know is that Ruth and Tamar have a lot of similarities. They're both foreign women married to Israelite men. They're both widowed. They both break customs to rescue their deceased husband's legacy. And the townspeople see what Ruth has done for Elimelech's line. The sacrifice that she has made and that Boaz is making. And they just speak this blessing over her. May you be like Rachel and Leah. May you be like Tamar. May you be used by God for something greater than you could ever imagine in this moment. And we call this blessing. Blessing. They speak a better word over her. I mean, think of all that Ruth has lost. Think of the devastation that she's walked through, and they speak blessing over her. I love the way that Dallas Willard put it. He said, "Blessing is a projection of good into the life of another. It's putting forth your will for the good of another person. You bless somebody when you will their good under the invocation of God. True blessing always involves God." And I love that these townspeople gathered at the gate model the same kind of character and faith that Boaz models. And the way that they model it is through blessing over fatalism. See, fatalism is the posture of just giving up. It's the idea that whatever's going to be is just going to be. But blessing speaks a better word. And here's the thing, you guys, you need to know that they speak this blessing into the place of maybe the most immense pain in Ruth's life, because she's already been married, and she was married and didn't have any kids. And so they speak this blessing of having kids and those kids being used to build up the house of Israel into the very place of her deepest pain. And I think in our day, in our time, we minimize the power of blessing. We minimize the power that our words have in the lives of other people. But there is immense power in the words that you speak. Your words, in fact, have power. They can create or they can destroy life. The words that parents, the words that you speak over your kids can create or destroy life. The words that you speak over your spouse can create or destroy marriages. The words that you speak over those in your neighborhood, your workplace, your friends, the relationships that you have, those words that you speak have an immense power to them, where God uses them in people's lives or the enemy uses them in people's lives. They can either bring life or they can bring death. Here's my challenge for you. Would you just look at me for just a moment? Over the next few days, you are going to have an opportunity with people, most likely friends or family members who you love dearly and who care about you. You're going to have the chance to speak a good word. And I'm asking you to lean into that moment, even if it's a bit awkward, to speak a good word, a word of life, a word of blessing, a word of love. You could pray for people. You could just say it at a dinner table. You could, however God prompts you to do it, would you lean into that moment? I love the way that these townspeople just speak a better word over Ruth's pain. And listen to the way the story begins to come to a conclusion. It says, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. And he went into her, meaning he slept with her, and the Lord gave her conception and she bore a son. Now really quick, I just want you to notice that it says, and Boaz took Ruth, and then there's a comma. Normally, you could do this afternoon if you wanted to, just glance through the book of Ruth. In almost every other time Ruth is mentioned, she's called Ruth the Moabite. Here, it's just Ruth. It's as though her story has been incorporated into the story that God is telling. And Ruth became his wife. He went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. There's a lot of conversation about who the redeemer is that they are referring to. It could be Boaz, and it could be God. They both are redeemers in this story. But in this context, the women are speaking a blessing over Ruth, and they're saying that the Redeemer is somebody who's coming to her on this day, meaning that the Redeemer is the baby, the baby who's being born. And listen to the way that they define redemption. He shall be to you a restorer of life, and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you is more to you than seven sons has given birth to him. Now, they're saying all of this to Naomi, not to Ruth. Remember, Naomi is the same one that they had a conversation with when she walked back into Bethlehem a number of months earlier, and they said, oh, hey, it's Naomi. And she's like, hey, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because I'm no longer pleasant, which is what Naomi means. I'm bitter, which is what Mara means. Call me bitter. The same women, I think, are having this conversation with her. And I love that we see that God, when we express our true emotion and our hurt and our pain to God, God's not like, hey, that's a little bit too much for me. God's not like, if you're going to talk to me, then I'm done with you. You're canceled. No, God continues to stick with Naomi. He continues to bless Naomi. He continues to work in Naomi's life. And look at the way that redemption is defined. Restorer of life, meaning that God starts to take all of the pain and all of the sorrow, and he starts to breathe life back into the things in our past that are broken. Somebody say praise God. But not only that, he's the nourisher of your old age. So God doesn't just do something to our past. He doesn't just forgive our past. He empowers our future. Oh, the restorer and the nourisher. Praise be to God. And listen to the way the story ends. It says, and Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. And they named him Obed, which means worshiper, servant. He's the father of Jesse and the father of David. Now, at this point, you just need to know that this story comes to an absolutely screeching halt. Naomi has a son? I just want to go like, Naomi doesn't have a son. Ruth gave birth to a son. I mean, isn't this a love story about Ruth and Boaz? I mean, as such, shouldn't the story end? Not with them like handing over their baby and exiting stage left, but with them riding off into the sunset like a Disney movie? Like, isn't that the way that this is supposed to end? I mean, what's going on here? Once again, Carolyn Custis James says, Ruth and Boaz aren't starting a family. They are rescuing a family. There's a big difference. In this story, they are essentially surrogates for the deceased Elimelech and the barren Naomi. And they step in and they come to that family's rescue. Friends, this is not a romantic comedy. This is a true love story. A true love story where two people conspire with the God of grace to bless another family. That's what this story is about. And it's ultimately not about Boaz and Ruth. The story is ultimately about a God who will never let you go. That's what you need to hear in the book of Ruth. Ruth is about the story of a God who will never let you go. Regardless of how many bad decisions you make, he will not let you go. Regardless of how much death and pain and sorrow you walk through, he will not let you go. Regardless of how much you shake your fist at him and say, how dare you, he will not let you go. That's the story of Ruth, that we can trust God to bring beauty out of even our deepest, darkest brokenness. Because God's redemption doesn't just cleanse your past, it empowers your future. See, the birth of Obed doesn't heal all the wounds of the past. The pain and death that Naomi and Ruth walked through is still there, but they're reminded that their story isn't over, that God isn't done, that he's able to take all of these disconnected pieces and these jagged edges of our life and weave them together for the grand story that he is telling, a story of restoration of our past and our failures, and a story that nourishes and gives life to our future. See, all throughout the story of Ruth, we see the way that God's redemptive plan moves forward through the radical obedience of ordinary people who had absolutely no clue that they would find themselves in the middle of the story that God is telling. When Ruth stays with Naomi instead of going back to Moab like Orpah, she's just living out the love that she has for her mother-in-law. When Boaz says that he'll redeem Ruth and save Elimelech's family after Mr. No Name refuses, he's just being obedient to the law. Small steps of obedience position them to be a part of the grand story that God is telling. They were just doing the next right thing, loving God and loving others. And I wish that I could sort of take you by the hand and just like the angel Clarence did for George Bailey on that Christmas Eve evening, and take you on a tour of your life and show you the way that those small sacrifices for the sake of other people and the love that you've shown to show you how that's impacted others. I wish I could fast forward with you and say, hey, here's how these small steps of obedience are going to radically change the lives of the people around you. Here's how saying yes to Jesus is going to reshape your family for generations. Here's how making a decision to step into faith is going to shape your family for generations. Here's how forgiving that person that wronged you is going to change the spiritual atmosphere of your family. Here's how being generous is going to reshape the lives of so many people in your midst. I wish I could take you on a tour to say, like, here's how your small steps of obedience are going to impact the lives of those around you. I can't take you on that tour, but I can take you to Ruth and say, God did it then, And God is not done using small steps of obedience for the glory of his name and for the good of people. And it's through your integrity, through your sacrifice, and through the words of blessing you speak over others, these seemingly small acts of faith create huge waves of grace. And so look at the end of this book with me. It says, and now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Ruth. Sorry, no, he didn't. With Ruth, Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. And this is the moment in the story that we see that Boaz will not only rescue Elimelech's family, but that he'll become a part of the Davidic line, the line of Jesus that will one day rescue all humanity. See, friends, the book of Ruth shows us God's redemption of one family that foreshadows his rescue of all through Jesus. And it's a wonderful redemption. So for one last time, maybe it shouldn't surprise us that this story is taking place in Bethlehem. Try this on for size and see if the storyline sounds familiar. There's a baby born in Bethlehem. How are we doing so far? His birth is miraculous and it's a gift of grace. The baby is referred to as a redeemer. And it's said that he will restore and nourish. His parents recognize that the child serves a greater purpose than simply being their son. He brings back a family from death. And he perpetuates their name. His birth means that even a foreigner, Ruth the Moabite, would be included in the line of the Messiah. And if you didn't know that you were talking about the book of Ruth, you would think you were talking about the Christmas story. Maybe it's both. Maybe in Bethlehem, the house of bread, there were breadcrumbs laid down over 1,000 years earlier that would lead us to the child who would redeem us all. So every Christmas we sing, O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in those dark streets shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Lord, we thank you for the way that you weave your redemption in the midst of our pain and our brokenness, in the midst of our faithfulness and our failures. And God, we ask that you would show us just a little glimpse of the way that you're working in our lives for the glory of your name. That you would give us the faith to walk with small steps of obedience, with confidence that you're on the move and that you're working and that you're doing things greater than we could ever, ever imagine on our own. You are a good and faithful God. We love you. We worship you. We celebrate you today and say, would you use our lives for your story and the glory of your name, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening to our service. We'd love to have you join us in person. For more information about our church and service times, please visit efcc.org. If you would like to support the ministries of Emmanuel Faith, you can do so at efcc.org/give.